I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. So we want you to be a part of this with us. You can tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who you think deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teachersloungenIU.edu. Today on the show, it is my conversation with Anne Monska-Smelzer. She's a music teacher, although she often says, "I don't teach the violin, I teach children and their parents." Anne's the director of the Suzuki Strings Program at Northern Illinois University, where she teaches kids from 4 years old all the way up through high school. And some of her students she has for that entire time, their whole childhood. It's part of the NIU Community School of the Arts. And Anne's a practitioner of what is called the Suzuki Method of music learning. It's based on the idea that music talent isn't inherent, it's something that's nurtured through positive encouragement. And the method's how Anne learned music back when she was a little kid, when the philosophy was pretty new to the U.S. We talk a lot about Suzuki, what it's like when everyone in your family, spouse, parents, kids, are professional musicians, and what motivates her after nearly four decades of teaching. But before our conversation with Anne, we have an education story we want to share. Early this year, Northland College, a small college in northern Wisconsin, abruptly closed down, leaving students scrambling. And one of the many losses was the school's hockey program. And that was until another Wisconsin college stepped up to give the wayward teams a new home. Playing this game is a privilege. Don't take it for granted. Shane Buckley's preached it to his players countless times coaching college hockey. He heard it himself back when he played. You never know when you'll lace your skates for the last time.
February of 2025, got an email on a Wednesday basically saying, hey, the school is closing down. So that weekend was actually playoffs for hockey. So we weren't even done with our season yet.
Buckley was the head men's hockey coach at Division III Northland College, a tiny school steps from Lake Superior, which was also his alma mater. The news was shocking. It was a lot to process. But Buckley's first thought was about the team.
These 27 guys, where are they going to go next year?
He quickly called the team together. They heard the news the same time he did. And even though they were in the middle of playoff prep, he gave them a choice. Do you want to go home or do you want to get out on the ice?
Hockey is like our getaway. All the problems go away once you hit the ice. And I think that's what everyone wanted to do was just kind of forget about it and just do the thing that we love the most.
That's defenseman Sam Holey. The Northland women's team was also preparing for a playoff game. Forward Kennedy Grucke says the closure was hard to believe, but they knew the college was struggling. Northland nearly closed the previous year and raised over $1 million to keep the doors open. But Grucke says they were promised they'd have more time.
All the incoming freshmen from last year assumed that they'd be able to graduate the year after. Recruits that came in were told that they'd be able to graduate as well.
That week was a whirlwind. Grucke's teammate Rachel Fusi says it brought the community together, but putting on her Northland jersey for the last time was really hard, especially knowing it would be the last time anyone put on that jersey.
We're leaving all our best friends behind, and it was very emotional, and for me, it was almost hard to focus on the game because I was so caught up in what's going to happen after this.
On the same day he learned the college was closing, Shane Buckley got an email from Beloit College. And they didn't have a hockey program, but they were interested in starting one by bringing in Northland's players and coaches. Buckley told his seniors, like Holey, but didn't want to get the team's hopes up too much in case the opportunity fell through.
Last year, you know, I was the only captain on the team, and he kind of put that trust in me. So to show him that I have trust in him, I was just like, hey, wherever you end up going, like, that's where I want to be.
Quickly after, Buckley and other coaches took a trip from Ashland on Wisconsin's northern tip down to the southern border to visit Beloit. Karen Shadeen is Beloit's VP for Enrollment, Marketing, and Athletics. She's the one who reached out to Buckley that first day. And as the college tries to increase enrollments and athletic offerings, here in Wisconsin, she says ice hockey seemed like a no-brainer.
It's sad to see another institution close. So really, our thought process was all about getting students a new home. Where could they go?
And it was a good fit. 37 students transferred from Northland to Beloit, only a few of whom were not on the hockey teams. It's a lot, especially considering Northland's enrollment had fallen to just about 250 near the end. Shadeen says they tried to make enrollment as easy as possible so players weren't scared of credits not transferring.
We took the approach that we were just onboarding them as Beloit students as opposed to putting someone through an admissions process.
That took a lot of stress off of senior defenseman Trey Taylor. He's one of the Canadians on the team, and the visa process makes everything complex, and he wasn't sure if he could afford to pay for an extra year of school if credits didn't move properly.
Especially with the exchange rate, too, it's not really too kind right now, so trying to find possibly a school that fits my budget. So that was kind of the real hard part about it, is there's a lot of panic kind of setting in.
Holy says it's been a smooth transition for the team, athletically, socially, and academically. In fact, he says with Northland's enrollment falling these past few years, it really limited some academic opportunities.
Our last year, most of our business classes, if not all of them, were online. So we were basically teaching ourselves because they were in the transition of getting new business professors. But unfortunately, they couldn't hire any to move up there and live up there.
He says Beloit's athletic facilities are newer and they have more training resources. They're also playing at the brand new Woodman Center in Janesville, which Holy says will hopefully help with recruitment. That was difficult the last few years at Northland with the school on the brink of closure. Last year, the women's team couldn't skate with a full team. Now, both squads have a full roster, including other transfers and new freshmen. About two-thirds of the men's and a little less than half of the women's team are from Northland. And Buckley says that Beloit feels like home now, and getting back onto the ice has been a relief after the stress and uncertainty of these past few months.
It's led to a really good dynamic in our locker room right now, where it's not much is taken for granted, because they know how, you know, based on our situation just a few months ago, things can change pretty quickly. So
the women's team recently played its first game, and forward Rachel Fusi says she could really feel the energy.
Our last game was really emotional, but this game is like, it's kind of like almost like a deep breath moment, like, oh, we made it, we're here, like this is happening, like we're having a season together, and it's something really special.
And crowds packed into the Woodman Center for the men's home opener. The puck drops for the first ever Beloit Buccaneers hockey season. But just because they're building something new doesn't mean they have to forget about their Northland roots. The former Northlanders have stickers on their helmet to commemorate their old school, and Buckley says even the jerseys retired at Northland are honored in Beloit.
Being an alumni, like, Northland and Northland hockey was always, you know, very special to me. So to be able to go back and be the last coach at Northland, and be able to keep those Northland traditions alive here, it has meant a lot for sure.
The Bucks fall behind 1-0, but in the second period, Beloit hits the equalizer. It's a hard-fought game. They trade power plays, the sides shove each other into the boards. Beloit ends up losing this one 4-2. But these teams have faced plenty of adversity before. They know this game's a privilege. They'll pick themselves off the ice and move forward. And they hope their brand of resilience will set the standard for the future of Beloit hockey. All right, it's time for my conversation with music teacher Anne Monska-Smelzer. And we start off talking about what it's like teaching her youngest students.
We start at 4 years old, so thus necessitating the parent help. And then they go all the way through graduating. I'm getting a couple seniors ready for, college applications and all that, whether they go into music or not.
That's exciting. And so do you have, I imagine, some that you have pretty much throughout that entire journey then?
Yes. And that is such a gift. Yeah. To see how they grow. I mean, they change and don't change, 4 to 18.
That's what we were talking about before we started recording, was that one thing that is, more unique to music teaching in a way that if you're a sixth grade social studies teacher, you don't necessarily get to follow students year to year and see how they change and don't change. And
absolutely,
it's got to be one of the more rewarding parts of the job for you, I'd imagine.
It really is. I mean, I'm getting a little better at letting them go and not, knowing that that's what's supposed to happen. But it's quite emotional, when you've had that journey together. And I guess the through line is I always know something good is going to happen. Like, you know, that we go through some rough patches. You have to when you are that, you know, together that long. But honestly, it's growing up with the parent and the child, you know, and yourself together, because you change that time. You learn a lot more. And it's just, it's a real pleasure to have that journey together.
Yeah. It's got to, you have to have some really fun and interesting first lessons when they come in at 4 years old with the parent that has to, I want you to just paint a picture for me about what that looks like.
Well, they could hide under the piano, refusing to come out. They could.
On top of the piano, maybe even?
we have some boundaries. Now this is rare, but I mean, that has happened. Yeah. And now that person is, you know, playing actually now in New Zealand Symphony, fully employed with a wonderful gig. So, you know, it's, you just have the belief that it will all work out.
Well, and it's fascinating too, right? When you have kids that young, that there's so much, A, just like trust that parents have to have with the process and you, that like, you know, there's probably not a ton, or at least I would imagine, 4-year-olds that come in with like a fervent love of the viola right away, right?
Nope.
That would be really interesting, but probably.
But I mean, there's enough things, you know, it used to be on Sesame Street and then it was Baby Einstein, you know, some of them will come in and the parent, they drag their parent in, you know, even that young, and saying, you know, consistently, you know, my daughter said since 2, she wants to play the violin and here we are, which is great. Yeah. That was not the case with my daughter. You know, I got a lot of, you chose this for me, you know, and later, thanks for choosing this for me. But
that's tough though, because, you know, you have to, again, have that trust and that belief that there is going to be that on the other side, that they are going to say thank you for that experience, and instead of just leaving us at the, why did you make me do this?
Exactly. And, you know, as soon as the child realizes, you know, they live in magic world, as soon as they realize it's work, they'll want to quit. And that's
so
when
the job is to make them believe that it's not work.
Well,
or just or that it's work worth doing.
Or that their life is play and play is work. And so, you know, I delight in the Suzuki method. There's just that understanding that you build the environment, and you know, you don't want to change the child, but you can adapt the environment to be a playful environment or something that they'll want to do. I don't beg. That's like one of my mottos.
Gotta have a
I will
there.
Not beg, but I can work with the parent. You know, that is an environment that is more malleable sometimes than a 4-year-old. And so there's a lot of parent education. And when a parent comes in and says, is my child ready? I usually turn it around and say, are you ready? Because here's what it'll take. And maybe they want to wait a year, and maybe they want to do more reading or observe lessons or see what that looks like for the parent, which it's of the Suzuki triangle, parent, child, teacher. Whew, the parent has the biggest task at the beginning.
Yeah. And again, I feel like before we get deep into it, for people who are listening to this and being like, what are they talking about, the Suzuki method? Can you break it down for us? Because I know this is something that has been a part of your life since you were also that young, right?
Yes. Yes. I'll do the short version, and then we can expand from there. But Dr. Suzuki believed that every child can learn their native language at a very young age, and that is due to their environment. And so he felt that everything could be taught this way because it would be natural. It would have the empowering belief of the parent, assuming, or practice partner. Not everybody has a parent or two. But in the environment, most young children do the miraculous thing of learning their native language.
Right, right.
And so he really sat back with that. When he was a violinist, the longer version is, in his life, I like to think about, you know, trying to be in his shoes, this method that he created was grown out of post-World War II. Mm-hmm. A Japanese man with a German wife. And
very interesting for coming out of post-World War II. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so he you know, he was directly affected by the war, as anybody was in Japan, or, you know, beyond. And so he is incredibly idealistic, which I love. And he felt like if every child was given the sensitivity of music training, there would be world peace. There would be no more war. I mean, it's
you're huge. Right about idealistic then. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's as far as you can go, idealism. Yet, you know, we as Suzuki instructors, it doesn't have to be violin. There's all instruments. We say we don't teach the violin. We teach children.
Yeah, I was
or
gonna,
we teach through, you know, the musical instrument.
I was going to ask that because actually on your website it says Anne does not teach the violin. She teaches children and their parents.
Right. Yeah. So that's an important distinction. And whatever happens, whether they become professional musicians or they just have a love of music or they are just, most importantly, nurturing human beings, you know, on the planet.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating to think about music as a language in that way, because a couple years ago I was writing a story about literacy and about reading education. Yeah. And one of the things that actually at NIU, one of the folks who studies literacy there told me, which I thought was just a very evocative sentence, was reading is not natural. That reading is one of those things that, right, like if you set kids down and even read to kids, but like, you know, set them in a room with a bunch of Charles Dickens novels, they're not just going to absorb that in the way that, like, if you, you know, if you, again, if you speak to children, that's the way they absorb, like, their first language.
Exactly.
And that, like, reading is something to be very, like, intentional about, and like, there's specific things like that. But for music to be something a little bit more akin to language learning in that way, I think is fascinating. And you get to, you know, be not just a front row seat, but an active participant in helping craft that environment to help them absorb and also be a part of learning the, like, quote unquote, language of music.
Absolutely. You know, that's funny. That's our semester goal is music literacy. And
okay, yeah.
Yeah. And I've been thinking a lot about it in Suzuki Method, since everything is based on a language learning analogy.
Yeah.
We don't put the notes in front of them at first.
Yeah, how long does it take before you put the notes in front of them? Like a couple years in some ways.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. You know, you don't want to have a symbol there that's meaningless, just like you wouldn't do that with letters or words. You know, first you babble and then you create a word and then you keep using that word while you expand to other ones. And so it's not until you can hear pretty much any sound on the violin and and know where it lives and
right.
find it and not have constant you know, corrections on posture and that. So you're like, the instrument is part of you. You know what it sounds like. You know how to create it. Now we're free enough to be able to look at the music in front of us. And, you know, the playing level, it gets ahead of the reading level, but we want those to meet up. We want everybody to be musically literate, you know.
Yeah.
But it's all in the child's pace. And that could happen. It's very individual.
Yeah.
Just like reading is, you know.
Again, another thing I saw on your website that I thought was really fascinating was you were talking about, again, the primary goals of this. And they said, or it said, the primary goal of study are to develop a sensitivity to others, the ability to listen deeply, the confidence that grows through persistence and mastery, and the freedom to self-express. And I was thinking about, you know, I like that word of developing sensitivity in a music context. And if that's something that over the years of teaching and seeing kids absorb that and, you know, take that sensitivity to heart, if that's something that, like, does it easily translate to sensitivity and deep listening to other aspects of your life after you learn it that way?
I hope it does. I mean, it's in how we talk with each other in the lesson.
Right.
I mean, I think of when we meet for groups, like, I can't teach just individually.
Yeah.
Because a group lesson, when we meet together, it's like a laboratory for character development. It's how we speak to each other. It's how we share our music. It's not interrupting. You know, it's all those things. And we might be talking about a class of, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, you know, as well as exactly the same thing we discuss. And I do notice a through line of the kids that, you know, travel for, through the program, and the parents, you know, they say, I've really learned how, parents, I really learned how my children learns, and this has helped our relationship. You know, right. It's those kind of things that I feel like that's the sensitivity that we want. We don't want to, you know, open up their little heads and pour in information. It's, oh, I learned so much more from my students that don't learn the same way I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I want to go back to that. This is a structure that, that you were a part of and that like you grew up with the Suzuki method starting when you were three-ish? Or?
Well, I don't remember because I was too young, but I mean, we have four kids in our family. We all happen to be, you know, have gone into music for a career and a lifestyle.
And your parents were music educators too, right?
Yes. Yes. I mean, how's this for serendipity? Both my parents, they met at Oberlin College and were both in a music education class where the first film strip of Suzuki's work came and was showed.
Oh,
and
wow.
So, and it was a huge impact. It was quite a ripple effect. Well, fast forward to a few years later, they get married and have four kids. And we were really guinea pigs for this method that was new to the United States in the early 60s and, yeah, throughout the 70s.
Wow. So yeah. Do you remember, again, we were talking about when you have, you know, four-year-olds come in or even your own kids about early on, it could be,
yeah.
I don't want to do this. Why are you making me do this? And then it over the years develops to, I'm so thankful that you, you know, had me do this.
Yeah.
Do you remember for you early on, was it something that you took to right away? Or was there also kind of a time where you were, you know, not sure about it?
I knew I always wanted to be a teacher. I didn't care what I taught.
Really?
But that was sort of a, you know, I'm like, I sat my poor brothers down and had them do worksheets. You know,
they, you're in the right place, Anne. We have heard that story many times on this show.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. Sorry, Eric and Carl. But sorry, not sorry. But I've had many students and parents, you know, struggle with, I don't want to force my child. It's actually more prevalent in parenting styles these days.
Okay.
I don't know that it's so much post-pandemic, but it's a lot of things. And my own kids have, you know, gone through that. And my feeling, I really had to get clean with this because I didn't want to ruin it for my own children as well as, you know, any students I work with. But one of the gifts of Suzuki training is mastery. And I feel like that is something not always easily understood.
Yeah.
In many things. You know, sometimes we do something and then move on to something else, or, you know, we have a shorter attention span for things. But mastery is something that I do believe is an important thing. And I feel like, especially we're talking 4 or 5 year old, you can't know if you like something until you can really know what it's like to be artistically expressive. You know, whether that's, you know, playing a folk song or playing a concerto. But I feel like the child needs to be at a certain level to be able to decide for themselves.
Right. To see that full expression before they decide it's not for me. Almost like to, you know, see the fruits of your labor just a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, what I love is I have some parents, I mean, one parent in particular brought their child. I always like to know the why. Why do you want this for your child? Because that can really strengthen their, you know, thoughts later.
Right.
What is your why? Why do you want this for your child? This parent said, everything comes easily to my child, but I know this won't.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I thought, well, what a great reason. Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. It was so not easy, but they learned a lot about each other. And once the child was playing artistically and the mom realized this child is doing it for her, not for him.
Yeah.
Took all those life skills learned through music and put it into soccer. And so it felt like Suzuki soccer. So like the understanding of hard work and mastery and this and that, you know, that passion was there for soccer. Not so much for music, but it was a very positive experience. Nevertheless, like nothing is lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the why of why parents come in, I don't know if that's unusual for the why not to be connected to music really in any way.
Sometimes it's not. But, usually it's something like I want them to appreciate music. It's something that was given to me, or it's something that wasn't given to me.
Yeah.
Or it's something I quit, you know.
Oh, those, yeah.
The typical.
It's like, it's same thing with our, you know, when we say what teachers inspired you, usually, right. Or why'd you become a teacher in the first place? It's either I want to emulate a teacher I had and be that for someone else, or I want to be the teacher that I didn't have, right?
Exactly.
So I think that we do that a lot.
Right. Yeah. We teach what we didn't get or did get, and that's where it comes from.
And so you... And from a very young age, wanted to become a teacher, knew that you wanted to be a teacher, but weren't sure about exactly what that would be.
Yeah.
Do you remember at what point where you were like, actually, it is this. It is music.
Yeah. I asked myself the question, and I really think it was the beginning of senior year, which is dangerously late to be deciding you're doing something like going into music.
It's fine. Yeah. Oh, for music, maybe.
Yeah, for music, I think that's usually an earlier decision. I thought about what it would feel like to not keep improving as a musician. And that felt like such a zing of, oh no, I have to keep improving. I mean, I feel that way now. So I wanted to, I knew that music in my life that way would be, you know, a vehicle for that. You don't know if you like teaching. I was terrified of teaching at the beginning.
I know. Well, we deal with this. In everything, right? Like that if, again, to bring this back to a sports analogy with soccer or with, I think about basketball, for example, right? Like people consider the greatest basketball player of all time to be Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan then went into, you know, front office and running a basketball team, and it turns out was not nearly as good at it. It's a different skill set. And so, again, like, you know, playing the violin versus teaching the violin is not always 100% translatable.
Not at all. Yeah. No, teaching was a totally different ball game. I was very blessed with patient parents at the beginning. I've gone back and apologized. I'm still in touch with so many of them, my very, very first students.
Oh,
and,
really?
You know, it takes a village. So they figured it all out. It wasn't nearly as much about exactly, you know, the tools for playing the violin as the passion and the belief in them and all of the things that, you know, matter really just as much.
Yeah. Well, and I was curious to ask, because you've been teaching kind of within the Suzuki framework for decades at this point.
Yeah.
And I assume that, you know, what that looks like, of course, is going to evolve as you evolve as a person, mm-hmm. as an educator. And again, how your style and the way that you teach within that broader Suzuki framework has evolved, if you feel like it's changed a lot through your career.
The principles have remained the same.
Yeah.
The what it looks like in society is different. Meaning back when I started teaching, right during, you know, I entered NIU college at 1981. That feels quite a bit different than today. It's not a lot of stay at home parents today. There just can't be. So I feel like it's changed in many levels. I mean, through the pandemic is freshest in my mind, but I feel like these principles, the language learning analogy remains the same, but society keeps moving. I feel like we kind of need these principles even more now.
Why do you think so?
Well, like I said about mastery, it's moving all so fast, and it's so, if you need something, you know, if you want to learn about something, you know, you Google it.
Instant gratification versus mastery.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think about that, about even like language learning, right? Mm-hmm. Like that we've tried to bring as much instant gratification as we can into a process that takes mastery, right? Like you think about the Duolingo gamification of language learning, which, you know, has benefits, has drawbacks, like everything else does.
But I'm on day 945.
Me too, you know what I mean? Like I'm very deep
into it. I can't put it down.
But I think about that, right? That like we know that within this larger societal place that we're in, like even things that take mastery, we feel the need to, like, I need a ding or a buzz every 15 seconds to keep me on that train, even if I'm going to be on that train for the next 15 years or whatever, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, positive reinforcement is all over the, you know, like that's huge. It just has to be for the work, not the achievement.
trust the process type of thing.
Yeah, the growth mindset, you know, has to be demonstrated, you know, in how you're working together.
Yeah,
that's the greatest gift for a parent can give a child. Yeah.
So you're like a senior in high school when you decide that you're going to go down the music pathway.
Yeah.
Is it music education right away, or is it just I want to pursue music and we'll see how that turns out?
I thought it had to be music education because I was going to be a teacher.
Okay. Yeah.
My dad was an example of what tired looks like because he did. And that's why we moved to this area. He taught in the public schools for over 30 years.
Wow.
He was the DeKalb High School orchestra director. And he loved it, and he was tired. And he would pray for a train to come so he could finish his lunch, you know, because he was going from school to school to school, and the station wagon was just filled with a bass or a cello, you know. It just I knew that wasn't for me.
Yeah,
you know, I knew it was too hard. I mean, to be honest, because I saw it all up close. And I really admired it, but I knew my comfort zone was more, you know, in the Suzuki realm of one-on-one for the most part and group lessons. Yeah.
And then your mom was a music educator as well then?
Yeah.
What did it look like for her?
Suzuki piano, private lessons in the living room.
Okay. So you're like maybe a little bit more like that than what the dad's going through.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
And so when you know, you're in school and after college,
yeah,
you did get the opportunity to tour around quite a bit to play as well, right?
Yeah. Actually, between undergrad and graduate, I got to study with Suzuki, and so that was
in Japan.
Yeah.
Wow, what was that like?
Yeah. Well, I loved being around. It was kind of an international school of teachers would come from all over the world, you know, to work with them. I'm really glad an adult sat me down and just said, go to Japan right now. I was doing we do summer training to get different units of Suzuki training. And my book 4 unit teacher said, get on a plane right now. And I wouldn't have done it. You know, sometimes you need an older, wiser mentor. And looking back, I'm sure she was my age exactly. and so I did. And I'm so grateful. It really shaped understanding the man. And, you know, a teacher teaches who they are before they teach what they know. Mm-hmm. And that felt really special to be in Shinichi Suzuki's delightful presence, you know, in a daily way. We had lessons every single day.
Wow. How long were you there?
It was just a summer.
Just a summer? And you feel like that was a really influential summer for you, though?
Hugely influential. I mean, he would come to the state. He would travel all over the world at that time.
Yeah.
And I think he was 87. I mean, my gosh. Maybe, you know, in his 70s through his 80s. But he would travel over. So I would see him at different places. But getting that summer in Japan was really, really life-changing.
And then after that, when you get home, is that mm-hmm. when the touring starts? Or
yeah, my husband and I, BC, before children, toured in a string quartet. And I'm really glad we had that opportunity. Yeah. So there was touring for playing. But also I've especially since I've become a teacher trainer, traveling is one of my biggest passions. But I want to be there for my students, too. So in the summer, especially, I do travel to all different, they're called Suzuki Institutes. So it's like family music camp, but I teach teachers to teach as well as work with the kids there.
Yeah, because it's not that you've been to Singapore, Peru, Mexico, all over the place then.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something that you still get to do?
I do. In February, I'll go to Costa Rica. I've been going there now 10 years.
Wow.
And boy, it is magical, again, to be able to see the progress year to year to year with a program that began from amazing, humble beginnings, you know, to growing so beautifully.
Do you see, you know, again, when you're going to different places around the world and there are cultural differences, there are a way mm-hmm. that education just functions a little bit differently? Do you see the way that also, you know, things are slightly different? Again, even though we're same principles that we're talking about,
yeah,
that it does look a little bit different if you're in Costa Rica versus outside of Chicago?
You know, there's a lot of things the same, but the difference is, of course, I have become humbled because my Spanish is pretty poor.
Day 900.
And yes. And but what I'm amazed about is how I teach better there because I don't use my words. I can use the music.
Show, don't tell.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And the kids usually in the program down there, the kids have a better understanding of English than their parents do. So they help their parents. So it's a kind of cool shared power dynamic.
Yeah.
But we also, one of the most special moments, I think both in Peru and in Costa Rica is, you know, Suzuki, it does rely so heavily on parents, but we actually, we're able to work with an orphanage. And so older siblings and older students were kind of taking the role of the parent. And it's just so adaptable. And I felt like I learned much more than the students or families in those particular situations because I came back with, oh my gosh, are we privileged? You know, like,
yeah.
I can be so thankful for... If I need my bow rehaired, I can just travel 25 minutes, you know, or get a set of strings. That's not available sometimes financially and most often, you know, it just isn't there. So, the teachers, we travel together to these places, try to bring as much equipment, you know, gently used or donations as we can. So we can just make their lives a little easier. But boy, they teach me so much.
Yeah.
About what's possible.
And with the parents being such a major part of this, that's another thing I'm sure evolved over the course of your career, that when you started as a teacher, you had that experience of being a student and being a, you know, child through that program. And then you, you know, obviously you get married, you have your own kids that have now gone through that. So now you have kind of the full range of that triangle perspective.
Right. Now I'm like the age of their grandparents, you know, so which is another perspective. And
absolutely.
I was kind of scared to tell a parent how to parent.
Yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't you be, right?
Yeah.
You're younger than they are at the beginning. That's the scariest part for new teachers. But I always impart with the teachers I, you know, work with now is, but you're a rock star in the child's eyes and you're an expert on your instrument. And it is your job to build the environment, which means the parents. And so you need to teach them what you need or, you know, what their child needs for the best outcome.
And so you mentioned that you had kids that also went through this as well and are also music professionals now too, right?
Yeah, we can't help it. Our family's so
I was gonna say, insular. Your husband is also a music educator. Your parents are music educators. Is it something that on Thanksgiving, are you guys like, are we only talking about music or is it like, can we talk about anything else except music? Like, what does that dynamic look like?
It's pathetic. We just got together for my mom's birthday a couple weeks ago and, you know, it was my brother's. And usually we're just sharing hilarious teaching or gig stories.
Oh.
So it's that. It's not like talking about, we don't sit down and analyze the harmonic structure of, you know, anything.
You guys aren't talking about Lydian modes
all
the time?
Oh, Lord, no. No, but my sister married a lawyer, so he put the kibosh on it one year.
Yeah, he's like, what's it like for that guy? Everything is so inside baseball, and he's like, I have no idea what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we try to balance it out. But whenever I meet somebody that's not a musician, I say, what does your life look like? I just don't know.
Yeah, you guys have to have so many great teaching stories that you get
to share. Oh, it's beyond. I think a book should be written. Yeah.
I have to. It's one of the things that I always like to ask these questions now, either at the beginning or near the end of our conversations too, where I'm always like, because both my mom and my stepmom were both teachers. We're both retired now. But again, that's like so much of the fun is that when they come home, they like every day they have a few stories of something either like really lovely that happened, really hard that happened, or really hilarious that happened. I was curious, like, have you had any great moments recently that you can share of just like moments with students that stand out to you recently?
Oh gosh, that I can tell
that
I can share.
That we can share.
I don't want anybody to, you know, names have been changed. So
again, it doesn't have to be an embarrassing thing. It could just be a lovely moment too. You know, just anything that stands out. Or it doesn't even have to be recently. It can be any kind of story of a moment that you have with students that you feel like is very emblematic of, like, this is why I do what I do.
It's not a funny story, right? Well, it's kind of funny, but, you know, I was teaching recently and I love it. I was at a workshop. I'll go with an outside story. And a little five-year-old, adorable. Most of the times when you go out to teach somebody else's studio, you know, everybody has their name tag, which is great. This little child did not have their name tag. And I like to individually meet them when we tune our violin and everything. So I said, "Hi, my name's Miss Ann. What's your name?" And he just smiled at me with these beautiful eyes. "Poto." I thought, wow, I'd never heard that name before. "Well, hello, Poto." And then he looked at me very, very angrily. And I was like, "No." I said, "Oh, can you tell me your name again?" "Poto." "Hi, Poto." "No." You know, he's just, I knew I was going to lose this kid if I said his name one more time. It occurred to me, like many five-year-olds, he doesn't pronounce his R's. His name was Porter.
Oh, you know, no.
Poor kid.
Oh,
poor
no.
kid.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
so, tough. But, you know, you have to take that moment, that breath, that what is going on here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have a lot of those, like, okay, we need to be patient for a moment.
Yeah, yeah. Take a breath. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway.
Again, one of the other questions, and we kind of alluded to this earlier, is always about the teachers in your life who inspire you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this could be other teachers in your life right now. This could be teachers that you had when you were younger. It could be Suzuki himself.
Yeah, that would be the easy call.
Yeah, people that stand out about why they, you know, made a big impact on you.
I have such an admiration and love for my high school French teacher, Madame Sally Valette. She's no longer with us. I wish she was, because I would be remaining friends with her. I know if she was still here. You know, I can see her sparkly eyes. I can, you know, her joie de vivre, you know, her, her passion was palpable. And, you know, she saw the person, the individual, before what they did. I have no idea. I don't remember. I probably got an A in that class because of her joy and passion, but that so didn't matter. And she lived to share, you know, the excitement, her excitement of the culture. We only had, I think, five people that went on this trip, but she managed for five of us to connect with DeKalb School, because I grew up in Sycamore School because my dad didn't want to be the teacher of me in orchestra, right? So she combined us with a DeKalb teacher, which I thought was showing community. We all went to France my senior year. I'd never been abroad before, and I know that that's what put the seed of loving to travel and seeing the world differently when I came home. It was absolute magic being in her presence, much like Suzuki. You know, it was exuding passion for learning, for other people, for other cultures.
It's funny to me that, again, your immediate answer is not a music teacher, but talk about the language analogy. It is a language teacher.
Yay! I didn't even consider that. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And again, like, you have so many teachers just in your life all the time, as we mentioned, like your whole family.
It's ridiculous. And my parents they did the greatest gift, which we passed on to our kids. Don't teach your own children. I mean,
really?
My parents practiced, you know, with me.
Yeah.
My mom drove me to, you know, far for lessons because there weren't as many Suzuki teachers, you know, in the area when I grew up. But I think that's... yeah, it's more expensive, but that I learned so much from my children's teachers, and so did my husband. I mean, that was a gift for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you don't want to take that extra special mentor in their life, you know, that they already have their parents, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your relationship to playing music these days.
Uh-huh.
And if that's something that also has, like, evolved, what does that look like for you these days? You talked earlier about, like, you decided, like, I don't want to stop getting better at this.
Yes.
And this is something that, do you still feel like that?
Oh, 100%. Now it's just maintenance, right? I try to get better, but it's like I have to keep what I've achieved. I love playing chamber music. I just last week played with Camerata Chicago. We did a children's concert, which is my favorite.
Yeah.
Peter and the Wolf. You know, like next week we got Halloween concert coming up with Kishwaukee Symphony, which is an absolute love, something my father started ages ago and now my husband conducts. I mean, it's just, it's family and it's people who want to be there.
Yeah.
It's not a job. It's, you know, I feel like that feeds myself and the teaching maybe is for myself and others, but I'm not as good of a teacher if I'm not working myself on the same things I'm asking.
And yeah, we talked about you and your family. You guys are talking about music and stories about teaching, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you get to play together very often, either with your husband or your kids? Do you get to play with your parents very much when you were younger, maybe?
Yes. We did a lot of family concerts together. I'm embarrassed to say very begrudgingly. I mean, I remember we didn't mind the playing. It's the practicing for it that we didn't want to do.
Yeah.
Typical.
Sure.
You know, during the pandemic, both my kids were... They weren't launched on their careers yet.
Uh-huh.
My son was, you know, still doing work at Northwestern. My daughter was, she was in civic, but no orchestras were meeting. So we did play a lot together, you know, at that time. And that was kind of a, maybe magical for us, not so much our kids.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah. But my husband and I do, you know, we were in a quartet for a long time. And we don't play chamber music nearly as much. I love that he's a great pianist as well, so he accompanies my students. But we do play together in some vein. My brothers being jazz musicians, I've rarely played with them, but never did I enjoy Twinkle Twinkle Little Star more than when my brother Carl, who was a pianist, jazzed it up on the piano when I was doing a workshop out his way.
Yeah. That's lovely. And again, something that not a lot of people get to do, which is have that kind of shared creative experience with just people that they already, you know, love and, you know, are in their family or have a connection with, that like to be able to share that is, you know, a little bit different and unique.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my father passed away quite suddenly. And immediately, you know, my thoughts went back to being able to play, you know, like we had so much time together because it was through music. Whether it was orchestra or him practicing with me as a kid. I mean, he was a busy teacher, but he made time for those practices with all four of his kids.
Yeah. I'm sure that's something you think about with your kids too, like having time that was built in through that.
Our favorite memories, I mean, at least my husband's and mine, are the times at music camp together with the kids. Not necessarily the music classes. It's just, I mean, I don't want to say it's enforced time together, but it does take that, you know, precious time that you carve out together. And if it's in the pursuit of music and learning how each other learns, bonus.
What's something about teaching you just think is more important than people might realize who don't think about it all the time?
I get triggered by words like gifted and because I'd much rather celebrate what you can control, which is the work, the effort. I don't know if I have more kids that are neurodivergent learners now, or we're just labeling it that way.
Right, we just have more language for that, maybe.
Yes. So, and I do think it's way easier for me to be able to work with that in the profession that I do. I get to see them one-on-one, and I know, I just admire the school teacher that, you know, might have... I mean,
it's a different
30,
environment.
24
yeah.
different learners at once. But I feel like if we can make sure that how we're structuring things is based on what is possible for the child, I mean, it's growth mindset. It's making sure we're not comparing, you know, it's the ranking. An example that
the
I
numbers.
Need. Yeah. yeah. Right. I mean, the child's internal voice, you know, it is first their parents, but it's so much then becomes what is told to them of how they rank in school. And so I don't have all the answers for this at all, but I do think it's important that we
always focus on the effort being produced rather than the achievement resulting it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's a numbers game.
And we want so badly for things to be simple enough that we can define it and we can show mm-hmm. it off with just one number, which is something that with what you guys do is, you know, just impossible.
It's impossible. It's impossible to quantify. Yeah.
And then just what's something about music and teaching music that you think is more important than people might realize?
Well, for me, I mean, it's like I said, I teach the child, not the instrument. But I think the unsung heroes in almost any educational and especially artistic endeavor are the parents.
Yeah.
And it is so easy to get, and this goes back to the first statement, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in, will my child succeed? Where will they go to school? You know, all of that. I'm kind of looking at a mirror, you know, and be anxious about all of that. But focusing forward on what do we want and what can we nurture, which is the environment, not changing the child, but changing, you know, adjusting the environment to serve the child. I know that's really general.
Yeah.
Yet, I think we need to empower parents, invite parents in more, like let them tell the truth, you know, about what's going on with a relationship, and know that everybody struggles, and that making sure there's resources, especially early on, because that child's inner voice, it starts with their parent, and sometimes it doesn't even ever change. You know, we can choose different things as we grow. Parents are not perfect, but I think just being open in the conversation of, you know, with parents of how can we support you so you can support your child under any endeavor.
Yeah. And the last question I want to have for you is just looking to the future, are there things about teaching or playing or anything else that you do with your career that you just feel like you're more excited about now than you have been before?
Oh, I'm just grateful. I mean, I had an injury, a frozen shoulder a couple of years ago, and I couldn't play. I couldn't play for
how long?
About 6 to 8 months. And
probably the first 6 to 8 months that you didn't play
of my life.
Oh my gosh, that's tough. That's like, again, that's like such a big part of your identity.
Oh yeah. So I had to do some real soul searching. And, you know, I tell everybody, I try to, you know, show that we are not our playing, that, you know.
Yeah.
But that was rough.
It's a part of you, of course.
Yeah. But it did also, you know, I had to get kind of clean with, okay, if I can't play, you know, what other artistic pursuits can I do? I knew teaching didn't feel as good, because I couldn't demonstrate, but the music should come from the child, you know. So there's adaptations, I think, that were helpful. But I guess I'm coming so much from gratitude now that I don't look at anything. I hope I didn't before, you know, as, you know, now it's just like, I get to play whole notes, you know, for a Pops concert. You know, it's all music. And I'm just very grateful. Grateful that we have music, grateful that we have this community that we do in our area. Oh my gosh, our school music teachers, they rock. Oh, they are just giving such a good foundation.
Yeah.
This is not to be taken for granted. This is not existing in many communities larger than ours. Yeah, we're very blessed for those, and they're sticking around. It's great. I mean, it's at an all-time high right now.
That was my conversation with music educator Ann Monska-Smelzer. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Ann. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And wherever you're hearing the podcast, please subscribe, leave us a rating, share it with a friend. It's the best way to get even more educators and even more perspectives on the show. A huge thanks to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of our show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin, and we will be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.